this effort did not grow out of the kind of activist community that we're used to dealing with. You know, there's a long-term activist community around the issue of Palestine around here. Some Arabs and Palestinians, but mostly non, mostly, you know, activists, peace and justice activists. And that's who you see typically around at actions and talks and protests around the issue of Palestine rights. But this this effort came out of a whole different place. Because it was organized by George Galloway, who is a British MP, and his staff people, they were the principal organizers of it. And because of his particular organizing background and his constituencies in London, his approach was not to go to the activist community, but to go to the Palestinian and Arab communities in the United States. And in the weeks leading up to this convoy, he had a series of meetings across the U.S. in areas where there were substantial Palestinian-American communities, and not including Boston. We have some Palestinians here, but there's not really a community per se. He was in Chicago, Detroit, Southern California, and New Jersey, which we don't necessarily think of as a big Palestinian population, but they were actually probably the largest group and the most distinctive. And as a consequence, the 200 or so people that were on this convoy, maybe two-thirds of them were Palestinian Americans. Many, maybe the majority on the young side, from, you know, college students to young professionals. And only about a third of the people on the convoy were people like me, you know, sort of activists, non-Arab activists who, you know, felt very strongly about this issue. So it was really a revelation to be with this group. It was culturally totally different from any other kind of activity I'd participated in. And as I told you earlier, because we had lots of time, like it or not, while they were trying to unravel the bureaucratic obstacles to us getting to Gaza, it was a chance to get to know these folks in a way that you know, was very unusual.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is as you got closer and closer to the Gazan border, to the border of the Palestinian Authority, you were learning more and more about the Palestinian diaspora by being in close contact with Palestinians whose families had emigrated to the U.S.
Exactly. Because I've been to, you know, Palestine many times, I speak a little bit of Arabic, very little, but that's little bit is more than almost any other American activist do. And I got to be kind of to these younger Palestinians who almost all spoke Arabic as well as English. They're U.S. born. I was sort of their uncle. And I enjoyed that a lot. You know, I have, you know, college age kids myself, and it was just a nice feeling to be accepted as family by these kids. And I hung out with them, and, you know, we did, again, while we were waiting, we did some tourist stuff in Egypt together. And it was just, it felt great. It just felt great. And there were also some older Palestinian Americans closer to my age that I got very friendly with. I socialized with a lot and got to know their stories as well as these young kids. And it was very inspiring. It was an experience totally unlike any I had ever had. And I got a huge amount out of it. Again, within all the stress, the difficulty, the heat, and the anxiety, and of course recognizing that we were trying to, you know, do a little bit to alleviate the misery of the people in Gaza, I have to say I had a great time. I mean, I was exhausted when I got back, but I had a great time.
Let's jump ahead a little bit. We'll come back to your travails within Egypt. But let's jump ahead a little bit. You just mentioned trying to help the Palestinians living in Gaza. And earlier I'd asked you to talk a little bit about how this trip transformed you. What was it like? What is it like for an American such as yourself, born in a country that has its share of poverty and racism and all the other isms, but for the most part is fairly well protected from the sort of devastation that we see in developing countries and other countries around the world, and what we've heard about Gaza at the moment following the attack by Israel late last year. What was it like for instance, only having 24 hours to distribute this aid and meeting people that when you leave, they go back to their lives living in rubble, basically. Talk a little bit about mm-hmm. how that affected you and what was it like, basically?
Well, I need to say in response to that partly, I'm going to describe the destruction we saw and the difficulties of life in Gaza, but it would be a distortion to only describe Gaza as the victim and the people there as victims. One of the revelations of being there is that despite all the destruction and the difficulties of living under siege, the incredible resilience and sense of resistance that we met and the willingness to strive to live as normal a life as possible was the most amazing thing to me. So I think it's important to recognize, you know, that the people in Gaza have suffered a lot, but that's not their whole story. They're not just these suffering people. They're resisting and resilient people. And that was really the surprising thing to me, because having followed the news of the Israeli assault on Gaza and the siege, of course, you and I know to follow it, you had to be on the internet or watch Al Jazeera, because we had very few pictures of it in our media. But I was prepared for the destruction. I knew about that. But the kind of resistance and the will to live that people expressed, that was something new. And I think it needs to be emphasized, because it's not – to view a people purely as victims is not always useful to them either. They're people who are resisting and sacrificing, but not totally victims.
Let me interject here another sort of spin on this question. Israelis, and of course the history of the Jewish people, has been one of some suffering, some large suffering. What, in your opinion, would life in the Middle East, in the world, in fact, be like if those two themes, if the themes that these are two groups of people who have suffered, but their resiliency is what the story is all about, if they could understand that together, Wouldn't that bring them together, do you think?
You know, in my experience, the Palestinians do have a concept about that. I mean, they understand. First of all, no Palestinians I've met either in the West Bank or Gaza expressed a kind of racial ethnic hatred toward Jews as a religious group. In fact, as you know, we had four rabbis among our group, super religious people who were given places of honor in the meetings we had. The Palestinians I know sort of recognize that the Jews had suffered in a special way in history, and of course, especially the Holocaust, and they have respect for that. It tends not to be reciprocal on the part of the Israeli Jews, because somehow they've reached the position where if they acknowledge or if they feel capable of acknowledging the suffering of the Palestinians and their own role in that suffering, somehow they feel that undermines their own claim to live in the area. So they have the blinders on about Palestinian suffering, not the other way around from the Palestinian point of view. And also, in my experience and according to opinion polls and so on, the attitude of Israeli Jews to Arabs tends to be much more characterized by sort of racial stereotypes and ethnic hostility to people as a race. Many opinion polls in Israel show that. Very little of that from the point of view of the Palestinians that I've ever witnessed.
It's interesting, because when the two gentlemen from the West Bank, one's from the West Bank and one's Israeli, came to the Boston area recently on the Combatants for Peace tour, mm-hmm. they were saying that, you know, 25, 30 years ago, it was much easier to live side by side, and there was much more rapprochement between young Israelis and Arab and Palestinians growing up together, and you didn't see a lot of racial tension. They were just kids playing stickball amongst the rocks and where they lived. And you seem to be saying now that there's a trend towards, at least in amongst Israeli Jews, of expressing their frustration with the situation in racial terms.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's similar. If you look at our history in the United States, in the South, where African Americans were the most oppressed legally and socially, the white Southerners were tended to be more at ease interacting with black people, so long as they were subordinate, than people in the North, and they didn't have that. And that's the way it was way back before the. You know, the struggle for Palestinian independence really, got its traction, that they were, you know, they were the other to Israelis, but they were the other that was sort of quaint and non-threatening. And now that there is a kind of a struggle, and the struggle is as much about the legitimacy of Israel as a Jewish state as it is about Palestinian independence, you know, those feelings harden, you know, then it's a political struggle. And the attitude of the Jewish Israelis has evolved over the last generation into a much greater fear and hostility toward their Arab neighbors. And this is, you know, it's a political function as much as anything else. Plus, there's also been an influx into Israel of, you know, over a million people from principally from the former Soviet Union who don't have any history of sort of in the area of interacting with Arabs. And, you know, sadly and ironically, they tend to be the most racist people among the Israeli Jewish population.
We're talking with Jeff Klein. He is a Dorchester, Massachusetts resident and a member of Dorchester People for Peace. He helps edit and write their weekly email newsletter, and he's a retired machinist and former president of his union local. Jeff, I usually don't ask questions like this, but I think in this context it's appropriate. Are you Jewish?
You know, I always get into that because, you know, my last name, Klein, is a Jewish-sounding name. And in fact, of course, I come from a Jewish family, and my parents on both sides have their roots in Eastern Europe, Southern Russia, Ukraine, Yiddish-speaking, and they certainly were very Jewish. And in growing up as a child, it was my sort of default identity. But I have to say, and not everybody likes this this response, I have to say that as a matter of choice, I consider myself human rather than belonging to any tribal subgroup of the human race. So, you know, I acknowledge my roots. My culture is partly formed by it. But I personally do not accept the definition of Jewishness as a sort of racial ethnic category, which the Zionists sort of promote. And ironically, the other group that sort of promoted that view of Jewishness were the racist Nazis, you know, who thought it was something in the blood, basically, that you inherited. Well, I don't accept that point of view. So I'm not religious. I'm not a believer. And my principal identity is not as a Jew, but as a human being who lives in the United States of America. And I guess my children would say the same. You know, that's their view also.
Mm. I ask because as someone who grew up Jewish and was bar mitzvahed, but has spent much of his adult life being critical of Israeli policy vis-a-vis the Palestinians, of Israeli foreign policy, of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis the Middle East. I'm often looking over my shoulder at people who are screaming, self-hating Jew, you know, at me. So I just was wondering if that colors your perception of the work that you – of the human rights work that you do.
Well, I hear that a lot also. And you know, it's probably true that one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this issue is because of my Jewish roots and the fact that whatever I may consider my own identity, from the Zionist point of view, I'm certainly Jewish. And in effect, what they do and what they have done, they're doing, whether I like it or not, in my name in part. And of course, as an American citizen, what the United States does relative to that is also in my name as a U.S. citizen. So it has become very personal to me. And part of that, I think, has to do with my Jewish roots and the fact that it's impossible to be neutral. You know, if you acknowledge your Jewish origins, then you're either for this thing or you're against it. If you don't speak up, you're for it because they're, you know, whether I like it or not, I have the right to Israeli citizenship. In a way that Palestinians who live there for 1,000 years do not.
It reminds me of, I believe it was a book written by Howard Zinn called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train.
Exactly.
Jeff, let's go back to your trip. You flew into Cairo, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
In Cairo, you met up with, I read online that there were about 200 or more people on this aid convoy.
Right.
And you acquired trucks in Cairo or in other parts of Egypt, and you gathered the trucks with aid in a convoy that was heading towards Rafah, which is the border crossing between Egypt and the Palestinian Authority, Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how many miles is it between Cairo and how long did the trip take between Cairo and the border crossing? And what was on these trucks?
Well, if you picture Egypt, you know, Cairo is on the Nile River, sort of 100 miles or so south of the Mediterranean shore. Alexandria is in the Nile Delta on the Mediterranean. And if you go sort of north and east from Cairo, you get to the Suez Canal. And the other side of the Suez Canal is the Sinai Peninsula, which is a big, mostly empty, mostly desert place. And then if you cross the Sinai Peninsula on the shore, on the Mediterranean side, eventually you'll come to Rafah. Now, how many miles is it? It's about 100-and-something miles from Cairo. I couldn't tell you exactly. It was a long day's drive. I know that. It's probably 200 miles would be more like it over. And sometimes the roads aren't that great. But if you'll permit me, you know, before we get into the details of the convoy, it occurs to me that some of your listeners may not have a good sense of what Gaza is all about and where that is, too. And if you'll allow it, I think it's worth sort of including that in the geography. The Gaza Strip is a narrow strip of land, and I often compare it. It's about the size and geography of outer Cape Cod. It's about a little more than 20 miles long and 4 or 5 miles wide. And it's surrounded on two sides, on the two land sides, by Israel. The fourth narrow side in the south is a border with Egypt. And it has a seacoast along that whole 20 miles, which is patrolled and blockaded by the Israeli Navy so that nobody can get in or out of that way. And basically, it's an area that was occupied by Israel in 1967. Its 1.5 million inhabitants primarily have their roots in what became Israel. They're refugees from the villages and towns in the southern part of Israel who fled the fighting in 1948 and then were never allowed to go home. So since the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, won a plurality in the election and became the administration in Gaza, Israel has maintained a blockade, basically. Nothing can come in or out of Gaza without the permission of the Israelis, and they basically keep it to the bare minimum. And the Egyptians, who have that short border with Gaza, basically are cooperating with the Israelis in keeping Gaza under blockade. Now, there have been numerous attacks over the years by the Israeli army into Gaza. The most extreme took place last December and January when there was, in effect, a three-week war, which was very one-sided. It wasn't a war. It was an assault on Gaza by the Israeli army.
We should just add that, in part, the reaction of the Gazans and the Hamas government to the blockade has been to promote the firing of rockets in the direction of Israel. The loss of life has been very, very one-sided in against the Palestinians, like 10 to 1, 10 Palestinians
100
for every,
to 1.
100 to 1 Palestinians for every one Israeli. But it's just important to put that in context as well.
It is, but it's also important to remember that if the stated aim of the Israeli government is that they attacked Gaza to protect their citizens from rockets leaving from Gaza. In fact, if that were the aim, there was a truce that they had agreed to with the administration in Gaza, that a six-month truce during which Hamas fired no rockets at Israel. No Israelis died during this 6 months. And Hamas was willing to renew the truce. Israel was not. And so I think you have to understand that if Israel's main goal was to protect its citizenry from these rockets, and of course we say rockets, they're something between a military weapon and fireworks, essentially. But if their goal was to protect their citizenship from these rockets, they had the means of doing it without launching this assault on Gaza. So it was a very conscious decision that was not a military decision to defend their citizens. It was a decision to punish the people of Gaza because of the choice that they had made in the election to elect leadership from Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Party. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important to understand that. So that the assault on Gaza, aside from the particular acts that were committed by the Israeli armed forces, many of which are widely considered to be war crimes, the premise of this attack was a war crime in and of itself. It was a punitive attack on a fairly defenseless civilian population, whose aim was to change the way they thought politically. It didn't have a military objective. It was a punitive attack. Mm-hmm. So the whole assault was a war crime, in my opinion, including many specific crimes that have been documented by the UN and human rights groups as well.
Do you think there's any validity to the idea that that because Israel accepts $3 billion of aid from the United States every year, and some of that money goes towards arming the country, that they have to use the arms? They have to find ways of spending the money and using the arms.
Well, I'm
not justifying using them against the Palestinians. I'm just saying, you know, maybe the U.S. has some, I know a lot of people say, including yourself probably, that the U.S. has a role to play in all of this because we're arming the Israelis and they have to find ways of using this armament.
Well, I'm not sure I would put it exactly that way, but it is certainly true that Israel's strategic stance in the Middle East involves maintaining the perception that they have overwhelming military strength, and that they feel every so often they have to assert that and use it to demonstrate, you know, the danger of confronting them militarily. And this was particularly true after their attack on Lebanon in 2006, the summer of 2006, when the whole world, was surprised at the effectiveness of the resistance of Hezbollah, the Shiite resistance movement in southern Lebanon. And the Israeli army got, in effect, a bloody nose. And since then, they have been actively planning a way to sort of reassert their deterrent capability. And I think that explains a lot of what the Gaza attack was about. And as you say, our responsibility has to do with the fact that although the soldiers, the pilots, the helicopter pilots and gunners were Israelis, their planes and their bombs and their missiles and their helicopters were made in the USA and, in effect, given to Israel. We give $3 billion a year of military aid to Israel. In effect, all this U.S. weaponry is given, not sold. It's bad enough we sell this stuff around the world. We give it to Israel so that the whole world understood that when Gaza was being bombarded, it was U.S. weapons that were doing mm-hmm. the bombarding, including white phosphorus artillery shells, which are made in the U.S., and a new series of bunker-busting bombs that was shipped to Israel in the months preceding this attack, clearly with the knowledge, the foreknowledge, that it was going to be used in the assault on Gaza. Bush essentially gave Israel the green light for this attack, I believe.
Mm. A couple of things. I mean, one is that what I think you're saying is that the Israelis needed to prove to their own population that they could protect their own civilians in the aftermath of the Lebanese campaign. And I wonder. I think it's worth noting that the Obama administration hasn't shown. Any particular signs that they're going to stop funding the Israeli military at this point?
Right. So far, even though I have to say the message coming out from the Obama administration is much more positive in terms of pressuring the Israelis in the direction of peace, practically speaking, they're not raising the specter of stopping aid or arms shipments to Israel. So that, you know, it remains to be seen whether it's a matter of pure rhetoric or whether they'll have any practical means of putting pressure on Israel.
Right. And, of course, the president made what some were calling this groundbreaking speech in Cairo in recent months. But underlying all of that is the ongoing U.S. support of Israel. Let's get back to the trip.
Okay. Okay.
What was on the trucks?
Okay. Well, it was a pretty logistically. It was a pretty complicated business. Okay. The participants in the convoy were organized in the U.S. Most of them departed on two Egypt Air flights from New York on July 4th and July 5th, arriving the next day in Cairo. I went on my own because I had a different itinerary afterwards, and a number of people joined up at different times. But the bulk flew together to Cairo with a lot of relief supplies that had been purchased and donated in the U.S. so that people were asked to bring a minimum amount of personal luggage so that they could bring on board the planes. There were wheelchairs, walkers, blankets, medical supplies of all kinds. I mean, just tons, everything that people could carry on these flights. But the rest of the plan was that the bulk of the aid would be collected and bought in Egypt on the way. And, in fact, that's what happened. There was a campaign to collect donations from Egyptian medical associations and other solidarity people in Cairo. And then with the funds that were raised in the U.S., over $1 million, we purchased stuff in Cairo as well. So the plan was this was all going on in Cairo when we arrived for several days. People were collecting supplies. We had a warehouse. And then part of the group, including me, went to Alexandria, which is the port of Egypt, to collect these vehicles that had been bought. There were 47 vehicles that were purchased with this money that had been raised, pickup trucks, vans, some passenger vehicles. And there were also four ambulances that had been purchased separately by another fundraising effort that we were hoping to take in as well. And the idea, the plan was that we were going to rendezvous. The people in Alexandria were going to pick up the vehicles, and the people in Cairo were going to pack up their stuff on buses and trucks, and we were going to rendezvous in Al-Arish, which is a city most of the way in Sinai, most of the way toward the Rafah crossing. And then the convoy would form up there and then go across the border into Gaza. Well, in order to do all of this, we needed permission, basically, from the Egyptians. And they were foot-dragging the whole time. It was clear that they were doing everything that they could to thwart this effort. And it was very fortunate that the people who planned this convoy had us arrive in Egypt well before the time we were actually scheduled to go into Gaza. I think they understood that we might have these obstacles. So we needed all the time that we had to sort of negotiate with the Egyptians. In the end, they would not allow us to bring the vehicles in, and we had to have a plan B. Plan B was to rent trucks in Cairo, and the rest of us would go by bus, and that's what we did. And there are some pictures that I'll show you of it was a convoy. There were five buses and seven substantial trucks full of aid that were sort of going as a convoy across the Sinai Peninsula toward Rafah. In the end, though, we couldn't stay for the 3 days we had originally planned. The Egyptian authorities said we could stay for 24 hours, no more. And the threat was if anyone stayed beyond the 24 hours, they wouldn't be let out. So it was a pretty substantive threat. None of us wanted to be trapped in Gaza along with the adding ourselves to the 1.5 million people that are essentially trapped there. So that's what we did. The vehicles are still in the port of Alexandria, and my understanding is that the staff of George Galloway has been negotiating, still trying to get them into Gaza, but failing that, to get the money refunded, which was $500,000 worth of vehicles that are stuck in port.
So what percentage of the – besides the vehicles, and I assume that those vehicles include the four ambulances – what percentage of the material aid that was in the trucks actually made it across to Gaza?
So all of it did.
Okay.
All of it did.
So all the aid made it, but the trucks are still in Egypt.
Right. And, of course, they needed I mean, one of the purposes of this, I mean, there's a dire need for transportation within Gaza. Even though it's small, it's not like you can walk everywhere. It's 20 miles long. And they haven't been able to import vehicles for many years because of the Israeli siege. And this was regarded as crucial for just, you know, maintaining their, you know, their infrastructure, including transporting patients to medical facilities, you know, who, as of now, sometimes people are wheeled on wheelchairs, you know, for miles to get to a to get to a medical facility because there are no ambulances in Gaza.
Talk a little bit about the Egyptian obstructionism you experienced, and I know you have stories to tell about the U.S. Embassy and in Cairo, and specifically these $30 documents. They made you pay $30 for these documents that you had to sign that said, okay, you can go into Gaza, but don't think you're going to get any protection from the U.S. government,
right,
even you U.S. citizens.
Now, I should say, out of this 200 or so people, aside from a handful who were from the UK or France or some other countries, they were all U.S. citizens. Again, even the ones who were Palestinian Americans, U.S. citizens. And you know, we thought maybe naively that as we ran into these bureaucratic obstacles from the Egyptians, that the U.S. embassy would sort of do something, because we were not only were we U.S. citizens, there are many U.S. citizens in Gaza that are trapped in Gaza, and I'll tell you later a specific example. So there were these complex negotiations going on three-way between the leaders of our convoy, the Egyptian authorities, and the U.S. authorities, both in Washington and in Cairo. And I should say, besides George Galloway, who's a British member of parliament, we had a wonderful city councilor from New York, Charles Barron, who's a city councilor from Brooklyn, who and some of his staff people were with us. And they were the sort of political leaders of the effort. And they were the ones who were negotiating, trying to, you know, reach some agreement with this three-way negotiation, joined later on by Cynthia McKinney, who was a former Georgia congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate. She had tried twice to reach Gaza with this effort of the Free Gaza boats from Cyprus. The first time, her boat was rammed and had to limp back to port, rammed by the Israeli Navy. The second time, they were boarded and captured by the Israeli Navy before they could reach Gaza. She was in jail in Israel for 7 days, finally was released, flew back to the United States, and turned around and flew to join us in Cairo. So I give her an immense amount of credit for her, you know, her dedication to this cause.
Like Skip Gates, she was arrested for tumultuous behavior.
Yeah,
that's a joke.
Yeah. She actually was, she like Skip Gates, she was almost arrested for tumultuous behavior in the Capitol building in Washington while she was a member of the House of Representatives. So all these negotiations were going on. I was with the group, the half of the group that was in Alexandria, sort of trying to get our vehicles. The other half was in Cairo. And they made an effort at one point. They made an effort to – the original plan was we were going to rendezvous in El Arish. And they actually got on their buses from Cairo and headed toward El Arish, again, just to sort of break the logjam. But they were stopped at the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal is you can't cross it. You know, there are a few bridges, and everyone has a military checkpoint at it. And the whole of Sinai, from the Egyptian point of view, is a military area. So they were stopped at the bridge going over the canal, and there was a kind of a confrontation there, actually. They were told to go back. They refused, and there was a kind of 8-hour or 10-hour standoff at the canal until they got word that we were all supposed to go to the U.S. Embassy to sign an important piece of paper that would allow us to get to Gaza. That was our understanding. So they turned around finally, and we went back to Cairo from Alexandria to go to the embassy to get this piece of paper. Well, it turned out what we had to do at the embassy, we all had to gather, raise our right hands, and swear that we had been warned by the U.S. consul not to go to Gaza, and that if we did go, we were on our own, and they wouldn't do anything to help us. And we would have to sign an official affidavit to that effect with a stamp of the consulate. And each of us had to pay $30 for the privilege of getting this piece of paper, which I still have, by the way, because in the end, nobody, the Egyptians didn't ask for it. And so I have this $30 souvenir which basically says, I have read and understood the travel warning issued by the U.S. State Department. I assume the risk for myself, and I understand that the embassy does not recommend my travel to the Gaza Strip. This was my $30, my non-tax money at work.
So Jeff, I think even those of us who have not traveled around the world extensively, but maybe have seen movies where people travel a lot, I think our understanding of our government's responsibility to us as Americans is that if we go somewhere and we get into trouble, we're just a phone call away from the American embassy or a consulate somewhere that they will help us. They were telling you, no, forget it. You're probably not going to get our help if you go to Gaza and you stay longer than 24 hours or anything happens to you.
Right.
How did that affect your decision, your final decision at that point to cross the border? And what were you thinking when you decided to go anyway?
Well, I mean, we understood when we were participating in this that we were not, doing it with the favor of the U.S. government. That's for sure. It was a little surprising to get this warning instead of help, warning, especially a few weeks following Obama's speech in Cairo, which, among other things, did ask for the loosening of the siege on Gaza. But it was, we were angry. First of all, we came back from Alexandria, which was like a four-hour drive to the embassy to do this, and then they had us pay $30 each. Well, the U.S. embassy, I think anyone would find, is loath to do anything to protect citizens when they're exercising their rights to do something that the government doesn't necessarily approve of. And there's a sad track record in Palestine. Several Americans have been killed by the Israeli security forces, most famously Rachel Corrie. And the U.S. basically never lifted a finger to ask for a serious investigation and so on. It also turns out that there are U.S. citizens who are in Gaza that are not being allowed to leave by either the Israelis or the Egyptians.
They're not being allowed to cross borders. Is that what
you're
saying?
To get out. Right,
yeah.
Right. And that includes—
Who are these people, yeah?
Well, it includes several Americans who came with one of the Free Gaza boats a while back and then are not allowed to get out. They're basically trapped. It also includes family members of people who were on our convoy. And I have to tell you one specific story. It's just heartbreaking. U.S. citizens who had, for one reason or another, had gone to visit Gaza and then found themselves trapped there. And one of the people I had gotten to know pretty well on this trip, a man named Maher, who was an engineer in Kansas City, and he was going to visit his wife and four children who were trapped in Gaza because they had gone back there to visit. And Maher himself had returned to go back to his job and left his family there, expecting that they would join him after a while. Well, they've been unable to leave for the last year, and they're all U.S. citizens. The children were born in the United States; they're all U.S. citizens.
Where do they live now?
Well, Maher lives in Kansas City, and his family did. His wife and children are still, as far as I know, still in Gaza. He went with us to see him. Many people were seeing relatives there. But in this case, his idea was to see his family and hopefully bring them out with us. Again, these are U.S. citizens. So when we left Gaza after this 24 hours, and by the way, the U.S. had made it clear that we were on our own. So if we stayed past this, we would have been trapped in Gaza too. He brought his wife and children with him to the Rafah crossing at the southern end of Gaza, in the expectation that with their U.S. passports, they would leave with us. And, that was part of his mission. Well, the Egyptian authorities examined every name that was trying to leave, and they had said they would only allow people to leave who had come in with our convoy, whose name they had. And, of course, his wife and children were not on the list of people that had come in with us. So here was the scene. He was there with his family. The clock was ticking of us having to leave. He was pleading with the Egyptian authorities, begging to get his family out. The answer was no. And he had to decide whether to stay with his family and be trapped with them or to leave and see what he could do to get some political pressure from the U.S. And that's what he decided to do. He was in tears. His children were crying, were hysterical, not wanting them to leave. And it was a tragedy. And,
so he left them there.
He left them there, went back to Cairo, hopefully to get the help of the U.S. embassy. Again, they're all U.S. citizens. So you would think, right? Egypt is in effect a client of the United States. You would think it would take was a phone call from the U.S. Embassy or from Washington to say let these people out. And so far, that hasn't happened.
So, in your just to clarify, in your understanding, there's no doubt in your mind that the U.S. government, the State Department, knows that these are, that there are American citizens of Palestinian ancestry trapped in Gaza.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely, okay. And among other things, you know, and other Americans too. So, you know, so far this new policy that Obama announced has yet to be have any effect on the ground, so to speak. And it's impossible for me to believe that Egypt is sort of unilaterally imposing this blockade on their border with Gaza without at least the assent of the U.S., because they're the second. Israel is the single largest recipient of U.S. aid in the world. Egypt is the second.
Jeff Klein, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this and relating the experiences of your trip. One final question. Will you do this again?
Well, if I were able to, I certainly would consider doing it again. I mean, the limiting factor for me is that, you know, we were volunteers. We had to pay our own way. It cost a lot of money.
How much?
Well, you know, the airfare round trip to Gaza, depending on how people went, was between $1,200 and $1,500. And we had to pay our own sort of lodging and food there, you know, so it cost a substantial amount. I'm happy to have done it, but it's not something I can do routinely all mm-hmm. the time. I am going back to Palestine in the fall. I go every year, and that's sort of my one big trip. This was an extra. I have friends in the West Bank and Palestinian citizens of Israel also within 1948 Israel. And it's important for them, important for me, that I see them regularly, because I do a lot of speaking about this issue. And just having been an eyewitness, it matters a lot. And it mm-hmm. matters personally for me to connect with my friends.